is 12 noon on Saturday. So I guess, it's Saturday afternoon, and we are attempting our second attempt at this show for today. We had major technical difficulties at 10 a.m. That did not allow us to even attempt to go into all the details of the show. We had 17 minutes, and then everything crashed on my end. So I hope that you guys can hear me now. But we're going to start with bringing in Susan Sparks. I think she is with us. I see her on my screen. Hopefully I can bring her in and we can kick off this second attempt at a show this afternoon. Susan, are you with me?
I am.
Gracious alive. How are you?
It's a beautiful day. Glad to be up on the right side of the dirt.
That's right. That's right. So, Susan, I apologize. You know we had technical difficulties. I could hear. I couldn't hear. My board, the board crashed on the phone. It was a mess. So I had to call Blog Talk. They had to fix it. They said an hour, but just to be on the safe side, we did over an hour. So I apologize to everybody. It was embarrassing. But hopefully this one will be much better. So, Susan, let's get right into things. Let's go over the latest numbers from this week, update our listeners on that. But before we do, let me give the numbers, 516-387-1865, 516-387-1865. If you're listening on the Internet, you can call in and comment on our show. But, Susan, let's kick it off with the numbers for the listeners. Go right ahead.
All right, folks. Here's our COVID update. Let's look back a week. Where we were a week ago was 152 staff self-reported cases of COVID-19 with 374 confirmed inmate cases. As of yesterday evening at 6 p.m., GDC was reporting 157 self-reported staff and 407 confirmed inmate cases. I think it's important that basing on the proportion of inmates to staff in GDC overall, what the numbers predict is that the inmate cases, if you have 157 staff, you'd have 856 inmates. And that number actually is far more reflective of the numbers we've heard this week from what's really going on with the boots on the ground. We've got three facilities where we had new cases this week: Smith, Wilcox, and Paulding RSAT. This is significant because it's been 12 days now, GDC began their, I guess, what's normal transports. And so far, they've had to transport, about 1,000 to make places to bring the people from county jails in. And they have made a good decision, that is to test everyone coming in from the county jails. So far, they have found one case coming from a county jail, and, of course, that's the new one at GDCP as of yesterday. We've got some places we want you to keep an eye on this next week. GDCP is continuing to add cases all the time. Altree has a number of cases, and GDC's official number is 70 inmates. But according to people who live there, it's from 173 to 230 inmates sick at Altree. Coastal continues to have new cases almost daily. Calhoun as well. Dooley has begun, and Dodge isn't reporting any officially, nor is Hancock, but at Dodge, we're hearing anecdotally that there are 3 sick inmates. And at Hancock, we're hearing 7 sick officers, one of whom is one of the wardens. So we questioned 2 weeks ago, as well as last week, the decision to begin these transports, and it does seem to be playing out as we predicted, that places that had gone 2.5 months without a case now have cases there. So that's briefly where we are, and I hope we'll start to see the desired flattening of the curve pretty soon. So far, we're not seeing it.
Right.
Okay.
So, and I think it's very important also that we just remind our listeners, for the ones that's new listening to the show, and for everyone else, that we believe that the staff numbers are what they say they are, but we don't know because they're self-report. Also, I'd just like to note that, you know, we said on this show, as Susan just alluded to, for the last couple of weeks about the transfers, and now we're starting to see that into fruition with the numbers rising at different places. And we also, you know, we can take the GDC at their word, but we're also, me and myself and Susan are hearing of just additional cases and numbers that from different facilities around the state that the GDC are just not reporting. So it's very important to keep that in mind. And Susan, I didn't mean to cut you off.
Well, you did not. That was all there was on COVID this week. Thank goodness.
Yeah. All right. So let's move on to our major topics that we really want to get into, because once we get into this, the time will be short, because it's something very important. So, you know, over the last few weeks in a couple of the groups, I've been reading about the extortion and protective custody inside of the Georgia Department of Corrections. And we wanted to do a show because we think it's very, very important that we cover these issues with you all. I think that, you know, there's a lot of questions out there on exactly how PC protective custody works and how the issues with extortion. And let me put this disclaimer out before we get on the extortion front. Myself nor Susan, and I think I can speak for her when I say this, we do not believe in paying extortionists. We do not condone it. We will never tell you to pay for extortion from your loved ones. I believe that there's some people out there, and in fact, I know there's some people out there that believe that when you are being extorted, when you receive a phone call, text, whatever correspondence you may receive from these people in prison, that they believe that you should pay it. So condone paying extortionists. Susan, am I right about that?
That's absolutely right, and there's some good reasons for it. You know, we kind of have to face this, that quite often the loved one is involved in it. So you have to ask, can I trust my loved one? Can I believe my loved one? Is it possible they're involved in it? There are a great number of questions on it, but I get these several of these a week. You know, a demand, someone's demanded money. They've got until tomorrow morning to get it, or something terrible happened. And
right. So let's kind of pick this up on the protective custody side of things. So first of all, what you should know, and I'll get Susan very briefly here in this conversation to kind of paint a picture of the cells on exactly how the cells are designed. And I'm sure a lot of you have seen the pictures or some of the posts that on social media. But it's very important for the loved one to know that protective custody is a right. It's not a privilege. Your loved one, whoever can simply request protective custody, and the GDC cannot deny them protective custody. Is so many things out there that states that, you have to, once they request protective custody, that they have to give names and they have to write a statement. The true part is they do have to write a statement. And I wanted to be clear on this, so I actually looked up the SOP on protective custody that was updated in 2018. And the SOP does state that the person must write a statement, and they have to give names if they know names. So it is not mandatory. It's not, they can't be denied PC because they do not know the name, or if they don't want to give names of the people. But, they do have to write a statement. So that part is true, and I don't want to go too far into it without Susan painting the picture of how these cells are designed. But also, what you should know is that once your loved one is on protective custody, they are to have everything that is offered in general population. They are supposed to receive everything that the general population receives. So if that's store call, that's tablets, that's a special meal that some of these facilities give out, whatever the case may be that they receive in general population, if they're on protective custody, they are supposed to receive those exact privileges that general population receives. So I just wanted to put that out there because I know that there's some facilities do not, once they are on protective custody, they don't give them the special but they don't give them the same things that they will give to the general population. So it's very important for you to know that if your loved one or someone that you know is on protective custody, I challenge you to ask them, are they receiving all that stuff. In a matter of fact, the SOP does state that they are supposed to receive their tablet while in protective custody and while in, and I want to say solitary confinement, but I'd have to go back and read it because, I read it earlier this morning. But they are supposed to have their tablet, and they're also supposed to be able to have access to the kiosk. And I want to make this point really briefly too, Susan, and I'll bring you back and I'll bring you in to kind of comment on where we've been so far. And I think we touched on this very briefly a few weeks ago, the GDC has actually updated their grievance policy. So if your loved one, for example, if your loved one is in protective custody or in solitary and they want to file a grievance about something or anything, these grievances are now supposed to be done either on the tablet, which is a gold device, is what the GDC calls it, or it's supposed to be done on a kiosk. So if they don't have these tablets or they don't have access to the kiosk and they need to file a grievance, they are not really out of luck. They can't. The SOP does state that they can request a grievance, but with the pandemic going on and with the COVID-19 going on, I don't know how much counselors are actually going through these buildings and actually doing the visits, the rounds visits that they're supposed to do, I think, two or three times a week. So, Susan, I'll bring you in now. I didn't mean to get long-winded on you, but I kind of wanted to make that point.
It's a good one. These two subjects today are going to intertwine. About the description of protective custody are individual cells. There are some two-man cells for some other things, but PC is individual cells. They are hardened. They've got stainless, not porcelain toilets, because you can actually break a porcelain toilet and use the parts as a weapon. The windows there are covered. The doors are a little different. There's little access to looking out, talking with others, that sort of thing. And people go to, they ask for protective custody for several reasons. They ask because they're afraid, because of violence, they've been threatened, they have a drug debt, they may have a gambling debt, or they're getting ready to be released and they're put in there just overnight usually for that. There are not really supposed to be any objections to asking for PC and getting it. However, we know in practice it doesn't work quite that way. I do want to say, you know, I talk about the Eighth Amendment all the time. It is an Eighth Amendment violation for people in protective custody not to have the same privileges that they would have in the general population.
Absolutely.
And by all means, document it and report it to the U.S. Department of Justice. It should not be this way, and yet it is. Often they are denied protective custody, you know, which is denying them their right to have a safe environment. But they're denied because they wouldn't rat out somebody else. And it's not a good reason to to deny it. But there aren't any good reasons to deny it.
No, and Susan, I'm sorry, Susan, and let me just touch on something really quick while this is fresh on my mind, because I'll forget in a second. All right, so they want you to provide names of the people, but and I think it's very important that we stress for the people that's on now and the people that's going to come back and listen. They do not have to give names. It is. I mean, you know, I personally believe that is a security risk for you to give names of someone that's to harm you in prison. You know, with the cell phones, with the various ways to communicate nowadays. You know, if you give someone's name, and you end up getting transferred, or you know, they decide after, or then that actually follows you, because, you know, if you give names, they're going to go and they're going to lock that person up, I should say. That's That's just they go and they handcuff that person, that whoever name you gave, and they put that person normally on pending investigation. And pending investigation is 30 to 60 days. And pretty much they don't do any investigating, let's just be honest. They'll leave that person in 30, 60 days in the hole. And then normally 9 times out of 10, that person is released back into general population. And then your loved one is sometimes transferred if they stay the course. And sometimes they're put back into general population because they're just so tired of waiting on the transfer. So we need to put that out there as well. Susan, and I'm sorry, I didn't mean to cut you off.
No, you're fine. You're fine. Go ahead with this, Joshua, about what really happens as far as the routine in there. I know they still have rounds required to do,
so they
with
do,
count before.
So they do have rounds, and this is very important as well. They have normally two officers that works the building. Normally it's one officer in the control booth, and then there's normally one officer that works the floor. And depending on what institution you are and how they operate, some officers come around every 30 minutes, and there's actually a door sheet on the outside of the room, and they actually are supposed to come around every 30 minutes to an hour and sign that door sheet. And they're supposed to do what you can call a wellness check, just looking inside of the cell and making sure that the person is actively alive and breathing and whatnot. Now, I will be honest with you, some majority of the institutions do not do this. You have some officers that will do a round, and you won't see that officer for 30, 45 minutes. Oh, I'm sorry, for 2 or 3 hours. And then you have some officers that actually do the right thing and they do their check. Now, on these door sheets that I was just talking about, the door sheets are assigned to log when the officer came around just in case something does happen in the cell. Now, majority of the time, and especially on the weekends, these officers will sign the door sheets for 3 and 4 hours. They'll bump the door sheets up 3 or 4 hours to make it look so they don't have to come around. And that's very troubling to me. Sometimes they will sign the door sheet one time and then not come around for until that afternoon. And to just to give you a testimony on that, I had correspondence with someone this morning that's currently incarcerated. Well, they dropped off their breakfast and dinner because the state does not feed lunch on the weekends. But they dropped off their lunch and dinner. I'm sorry, their breakfast and dinner at 9:30 a.m. And he said that they would not see an officer for the remainder of the day. And unfortunately, that is the practices that normally takes place at most institutions. Most institutions are so short of staff that the officer that's actually assigned to the hold may be working 4 or 5 buildings, well, 3 or 4 buildings, so they don't have time to actually stay there and do their checks all day. Those door sheets are designed for the officer to do 30 to 45-minute checks, and unfortunately, that is rarely done in the prison system, like I say. And how many times, Susan, have we heard of somebody had been dead in their cell for hours at a time? And the question is, well, where was the officer that was supposed to do their rounds every 30 to 45 minutes? How many deaths could have been prevented if the officer would just get off their lazy behind and actually go do their rounds like they're supposed to do? So that's one aspect of the protective custody thing. And I'll let you chime in, Susan.
You mentioned grievances. I had a note earlier today. Someone who's in protective custody right now, and he said that they haven't seen a counselor in weeks. And so they can't use their tablets or the kiosk where he is to file grievances. They have to do them on paper. And even if they have the grievance form, they're supposed to give it to the counselor.
Right, and they're supposed to give that grievance to a counselor within so many hours or within so many days before, and I can't remember. I'm not going to even quote a number, but I can't remember. But it's not very long that after the incident happens until they're supposed to turn in this grievance form. But go ahead, Susan.
That's the truth. Now, we know in practice that a lot of the things that they should get don't always happen. Back in 2018, I believe, 2019 maybe, the lawsuit that Timothy Gum brought, which was regarding the HIMEX, the SMU Special Management Unit at GDCP, isolation on steroids. A little bit different than protective custody, but lots more sensory deprivation. This man, Gum, had been there 7 years. They have to review him every 90 days and say yes or no, they'll keep him in. He'd been reviewed 17 times. He had been recommended to be taken back in general population 15 of the 17 times. And according to the lawsuit, and this is in settlement, so it isn't alleged, central office had denied him. The warden had approved him to go back into general population. But Mr. Gum and Mae Gum filed this lawsuit, and it was approved to go through. Southern Center for Human Rights got on board and helped rewrite it so it was stronger and more representative of the other inmates who were receiving essentially the same treatment. What came out of that, though, was each inmate in these situations should have 4 hours per day out of their cell. That the SMU should have a 24-month limit, and that they can be released from the TIER program as soon as 13 months. They should also have access to their tablet, to the law library, to a reading library, and for 120 minutes of programming per week. Let's just say that's unlikely that that's happened.
Right, and that's not happening. And let's touch on this TIER program really quick, Susan, because I think this is important as well. All right, so I think there's three or four phases of the TIER program when these guys are in it. Now, these guys can be placed on the TIER program for a little bit of anything, you know. And you know, since we're going to talk about this, I can't let it pass by without saying their TIER practices are absolutely absurd. And they're who they select to go on these TIER programs is absolutely absurd, because you had the case, and I keep bringing this up because it's very important. I want to keep this name out there. You had Mr. Eddie Gozer, who was at Augusta State Prison, who was killed a few weeks ago by his cellmate, who absolutely should have been on the TIER program, if not in high max, before his past crimes that he had committed while in prison. A murder charge, an assault charge on officers, an assault charge on a fellow cellmate when he cut his throat. But you know how flawed this TIER program is you have people that's on the TIER program, and I'm not making excuses for them, and I'm not saying that it's right. You have people that's on the TIER program right now for violations like getting caught with a cell phone, or getting caught with some type of contraband, whether it's a knife or whether it's whether it's drugs or whatnot. You have those people that's on a or let me even go a step further for participating in gang activity or being a part of a certain gang. You have them on the TIER program, and the fact you have a gentleman that's you know had committed serious crimes that's allowed to continue to stay in general population. But like I said, I don't want to be dead horse. That's for another show, I guess. But I just wanted to give I wanted to give the listeners an ideal on, you know, who exactly is on TIER. Now, I'm not saying that everyone that's on TIER, some of them it's for good reason that they're on the TIER program. And then for some of them, you have them on there for petty violations, too many DRs, you know, stuff like that. You know, so Susan, I apologize. Like I said, I'm not trying to preach or anything like that. I just kind of wanted to, I want to give the listeners, you know, an idea on who exactly is on the TIER program.
Thank you. That was well done. You know, regarding SOAR, I saw a SOAR sheet from the hole at Calhoun, and it only had about a dozen items on it. But the regular SOAR sheet that I was sent from a different prison must have had 100 items on it. And the guys who were talking to me from Calhoun said that of the dozen things on there, half of them were not available, not in stock. No ramen noodles. No ramen noodles in a prison. Other things as well that were common, they couldn't get them.
I think it varies from different institutions. I know at Dodge, if you're in the hole at Dodge, or if you're even on protective custody, and I'll tell you why too. Even if you're on protective custody, but at Dodge, you cannot buy ramen noodles. You cannot buy pretty much of anything. You can buy candy bars, potato chips, and hygiene products. That's all you can buy. I don't think there's a limit to those items, but that's all you can buy. Up to $60 worth, candy bars, bags of potato chips, and hygiene products. Of course, paper, pens, and stuff of that nature. But at Dodge, even on protective custody, you still can't buy that stuff. And the reason why, the warden at Dodge, from talking to someone who's pretty reliable, the reason why you can't buy that stuff there at Dodge, even if you're on protective custody, is because the warden is fed up with people running to the hole because they owe money for drug debt, and they're staying back in the hole for months and months at a time, and pretty much he's worrying about them living like kings back there in the hole, so he's not allowing even protective custody, which is wrong. It's not, you know, like I said, it's not the SOP for that to happen. But most wardens now are not even allowing protective custody people to buy that stuff because they're so worried about the drug debts that are taking place or is happening now. So, Susan, I think that's starting to happen everywhere. People are running up hundreds and hundreds of dollars on drugs and then, you know, running from paying that bill.
Yeah, you know, I hear it from a lot of the moms in particular. Little Johnny, you know, he tells Mama he's been harassed and he's in danger, and Mama says, you need to go in protective custody, and then she gets on the phone, and before the day's out, he's in there. But little Johnny may have a $500 drug debt for when he comes out. They'll be waiting for him. They do not forgive it. It is not going to be forgiven. In fact, it'll follow him wherever he goes. The inmates inside today are talking in real time to other facilities just like we are right now.
Absolutely. And Susan, it should also be pointed out, and like I said, you know, we're on this show, you know, we use common sense. You know, we talk, of course, we're advocates. We support the prisoners 100%, but we also use common sense, and we're not going to condone wrongdoing. Let's just be honest. And not all the time, and I want to be careful here, and I will be careful, because I do know that things happen where there are serious cases where people need to go to protective custody. With things how they are right now in the prison system, drugs and things of that nature are very, very, very easy to come by. Whether it be getting into the facility, however it may get into the facility, but officers or however they make details or whatever, you know, it's plentiful. And people inside of those prisons will front drugs to people. You know, they'll give it to them for 4, 5, 6 days, and that person can pay them later or whatever. So, you know, we need to be honest. You know, and I hope our listeners and the loved ones will be honest that, you know, and like I said, I'm going to be careful here, but 9 times out of 10, when people go into protective custody, it's because of a drug debt. Not all the time, but majority of the time, it's because they're running, they can't pay that drug debt. And it's unfortunate, but that's how it works. And, you know, like I say, it makes it bad and it makes it worse for people that's actually, you know, really need to be on protective custody because, you know, they can't get the access or they can't get the things that they actually are supposed to get because, you know, they have the administration and the GDC has actually, you know, found out and understand that majority of the people that go to the hole and request protective custody are, you know, running from drug debt.
Well, this is a good place to segue into the issue of extortion. When people contact me about it, they lots of times they've got screenshots and various things, but how common is it? It's very common. How does it happen? Your loved one should not tell anything about his family's finances, the home he lives in, the home his parents live in. That should be off limits conversation inside because the next thing, I promise you, it's easy to get people's phone numbers and the next thing you know, you've got an extortion attempt going on. And it may start with $50 by tomorrow morning, and then 3 or 4 days later, it's another $50. They're just teasing it to see if what are you going to do about it. Then it's $200, and then it's $500. So mom's asked me, how common is it? Real common. Should I pay it? I promise you, Joshua and I both agree on this. No. How can I make it stop? If you pay it, you can't make it stop. You have become a victim.
Right, and you got to use common sense. You have to use common sense. Example, you loan somebody money one time, and you know that person is just what's the word to use besides scum, Susan? Or if you know that person, it's probably not going to pay you back, or has trouble paying back, or whatever the case may be. And you continue to loan that person money. You do it one time, and they ask you to pay, and you do it again, and they haven't paid you the first time. That person is going to continue to come back and to keep, mooching off of you. And that's the same thing in prison. You pay them once, you're opening the door to paying, to continuing to pay and to pay and to pay. And that person, as Susan has just said, and she's absolutely right, you've become a victim because you opened the door and you paid them the first time. Of course, they're going to continue to come back and try to get you to pay more.
The largest amount I've personally heard, and I'm sure there are others that are much different, but the largest amount I have heard was $900 every 10 days. That's a serious drug debt. And that went on quite a while. The family was paying it because they thought that was the right thing to do, and it seemed like that when it was a small amount, but when you're up there at $2,000 a month, no, that's not the right thing to do. So people ask, should I report it? GDC has an SOP on it. If you report it, what they're supposed to do, you know, if you report who is extorting, they're supposed to take that person and put them in the hole until they transfer them. However, in practice, that isn't really what happened. I get it that it sounds good. But if you report
right.
it, who do you tell? It isn't clear on who you're supposed to tell. As a loved one of an inmate, you're on your own pretty much to figure out who to tell. They do not make it easy.
All right. And Susan, let me.
Yeah, pardon me. Go ahead. Transferred. The one doing the extorting is the one who should be. I've come a long way since when I got involved. And I thought, yes, the moms are trying to get their loved ones transferred, or your loved one needs to understand that there really are ways to do things in prison and ways not to, in order to stay out of trouble and out of drug debt, out of extortion. Anyway, that's about all I can say on that.
And Susan, let me tell our listeners this, and just to go down that road a little bit. And I was gonna try. I tried to have a mother on today that actually has been dealing with that extortion stuff, but she had to work. So I won't give her name, or I won't give her sons. You know, none of that stuff. Of course, like I said, that's every time you report something to me or Susan or anybody, it's confidential, and we don't tell it unless we get permission to tell it. But like I said, I'm sure she won't mind if I tell this part, so or just a little bit of it. So a few months ago, her son was being extorted at a facility, and myself and a friend of mine by the name of Larry, he actually contacted the Department of Corrections on her behalf for her, and the Department of Corrections actually, and like I said, I have to give them the benefit of the doubt when they actually do try to do right, and it's not very often that they do right, as we all know. But the Department of Corrections, within 48 hours, actually sent a investigator to talk to this young man and investigate the claims that he had made of being extorted. So there are departments within the Department of Corrections that will take these. If your son or your loved one is being extorted and there is a legitimate case of being extorted, and I mean, now you can't call these people and you know that little Johnny has a drug problem. I mean, you know your loved one better than anyone else knows your loved one. But within the Department of Correction, there is a department that actually will investigate these claims of extortion. And like I said, I don't care for the Department of Corrections at all, but I do, and I know this is going to sound odd, but I do commend them for actually in trying to stop extortion because, it's just not right. I mean, how many times, Susan, have you heard, and I've heard, of people not being able people are not being able to stay in dorms unless they pay to stay in those dorms, or people can't stay in a room because it's ran, the whole dorm is ran by gangs unless they pay a certain amount of money a week or whatever. I mean, that's obnoxious and that's absurd. So, and I'm coming to you, Susan. So I do commend the Department of Corrections for trying. In some cases, they don't go very, very far to it, do that. But they do try to stop, if they are aware of it, try to stop the extortion of going on.
Sadly, I don't believe you can count on that being the case every time.
Absolutely not. No.
If only. I think this is a good point about the inmate's been assigned particular housing. He's been classified certain ways. Housing and classification go together, and it's important. It's done. Some of that is done during the diagnosis and classification part. But once they get to the prison, they know there what the real housing situation is. They're supposed to be housed in such a way that they'll be safe. And yet, this is where they're assigned, but they have gangs that are saying, you can't stay here. You're going to another building unless you pay us. And paying might sound like the right thing to do at the time, but it opens the door on ever being a victim. So,
no, and I 100% agree. So, like I said at the top, don't pay extortionists. Don't pay anybody that reaches out to you. Don't have any communication with them. If you really feel that your loved one is in jeopardy or their safety is in jeopardy, contact the facility immediately. I know sometimes it's very hard to get into contact with someone at the facility because most of the times, and I was reading someone had tried to contact them this week, and one of the main number they had actually been forwarded to the call center. But if you ever feel that your loved one is in jeopardy, and I mean, I've helped numerous people the last couple of months get in contact with facilities about their loved ones, issues that they were having. So if you can't get in contact with them, reach out to myself or Susan. We will do our best. I mean, that's what we're here for, to do our best to try to get you in contact with the right person, either at that facility or within the GDC, to address your concerns when it comes to your loved one safety, and especially if you're dealing with extortion or anything like that. But like I say, it's also Susan, it's also your responsibility as a loved one to talk to these to your loved ones and let them know that the drugs and the debt and all this it has to stop. That you're not gonna be responsible for paying these debts, and they shouldn't even be calling you, asking you to pay a debt, and especially for drugs, and especially for things of that nature. I mean, I'm not trying to tell you what to do. At the end of the day, you're going to do what you want to do, but it's your responsibility to make it clear that you're not paying drug debt. And let me tell you this: 9 times out of 10. The person that's making the threats are not going to do anything. They're not going to kill your loved one in 5 hours for $200 or $300. It's just a ploy and a threat to get you to pay whatever their ransom is. And like I said, don't pay it. Just don't pay it. But at the same time, don't have any communication with them. Don't open the door for them to continue to send you threatening messages. Ignore them. And like I said, if you truly believe that it's a life and death situation, if you know that your loved one is not involved in drugs or whatever, then by all means, reach out to that facility and give as much information as possible. It's not snitching. It's about keeping your loved one safe and getting them home when they're supposed to get home. Susan, go ahead.
You're on a roll, man. You keep going. You're doing great.
I think that's important that we have this conversation because are we blind to understand that extortion does go on? No, we know that it does go on. But sometimes it's that particular person putting themselves in that position. We need to make sure that we're relaying to them as best as we can, to stay away from that stuff. Like I said earlier, drugs are plentiful. You have people that will pay instead of paying a 40-cent soup or a Roman noodles pack for someone to iron their clothes, they'll pay some melt or some ice or whatnot. That's what you're dealing with while you're in there. I mean, it's so plentiful, it's so easy to get their hands on they use it and they do it. And I think it's sad, but you got to be mindful. And they have to be mindful of where they are and, the peer pressure and the temptation on doing these things are, it's easy to fall into that trap of getting on drugs or, getting into debt, because it's – but, so I just think that you have to be mindful. But like I said, and I keep saying it, and I want to stress it, don't pay extortionists. Don't even communicate with extortionists. Don't talk to them. Don't open that door. Go ahead, Susan.
I couldn't agree more. I know this is a little different kind of a show today, but we have had, so between Joshua and I, over the last month, case after case of people contacting us about these very things. Their loved one in PC or their loved one in solitary being incommunicado, not being able to use the phone or talk to them. And then if they're in PC and they're hiding from their death, these guys that are doing this have cell phones just like you and I do. And they'll find a way to get to someone they think they can make pay little Johnny's drug debt. So
right.
Susan alluded to it.
Go ahead. And you alluded to it earlier. They don't need to be given their contact information to anyone. They don't need to be given their number or their loved one's number to anyone, because 9 times out of 10, it's not going to be used for the purpose that someone may think. And Susan, too, I think the listeners need to understand and what is very important, and it happens at a lot of facilities, and it happened at facility that I was at, where say that loved one goes to the hole, or they go out to the hospital, or they go somewhere, and it requires that their property is packed up. I'm going to tell you, these officers are lazy. They're not going to go and pack little Johnny's property. They're going to have two or three inmates in that dorm or in that cell house. They're going to give them a trash bag, and they're going to tell them to go pack that property. It's not supposed to happen, but I'm telling you, it happens every day. It's happening right now, where someone's been locked up or put in the hole or sent to the hospital, and you have people in these dorms that actually go and they're packing their property and they're stealing your loved one's property. They're stealing their food. They're stealing their tablets. They're stealing their personal information. And that's one of the ways that extortion happens. And I'm going to tell you now, if that has happened to your loved one, you need to tell your loved one to file a grievance. And then you need to also file a complaint with the Department of Corrections and that warden to let them know that's going on at the institution, because that goes on. I mean, you wouldn't even believe how often that goes on. And it's put in, and like I said, it's going back to the GDC. Now, the GDC is opening the door for extortion because their officers are not doing the simple task of going in inventory in someone's property and making sure that property is secure and safe. The GDC is opening the door for extortion. And they're opening the door for people, loved ones, to be contacted and giving their loved ones a heart attack because their officer is too lazy to get off their behind and to go inventory someone's property and do what they're supposed to do. So that happens a lot, Susan, where, that's one of the ways how extortion happens. I mean, with the cell phones and everything in these facilities, it's not hard for someone to get a hold of somebody's personal information. You know, if they're actually the extortion is actually extortion, it's not hard for them to get get this information, because the GDC doesn't follow their own guidelines when it comes to getting this property and stuff together. So, but go ahead, Sue.
I do believe that, based on what I hear from other people, that most of the time the property disappears most of the time. Sometimes it may be inventoried and moved with the inmate to wherever his whatever his destination is. But moms who've got, you know, 10 years into this, one of them told me that her son's in the hole like 18 times, and every single time he had lost all his property. And it, in there, of course, was her phone number is written in his Bible. And that's, you know, they have all time in the world to thumb through a Bible. So,
yeah.
Just,
I mean,
please, clear with your family member.
Yeah, I mean, Susan went to the Department of Corrections where they're mostly, even before the pandemic and COVID-19, they have so much time on their hand because the GDC doesn't offer any type of programs for its population, or they don't offer much of anything. They barely run yard because they're so short of staff. They barely do any gym call. There's just barely anything going on that these guys have so much time on their hands to come up with schemes and come up with things, that's going to get them in trouble that, it's just, they have so much time on their hands that, they can come up with anything, and so you have to be aware. And I want to stress, I just want to stress that if you're dealing with this, and you're hearing this for the first time from us, and you know now it's starting to make sense on what's going on. If you're dealing with this, contact the institution where your loved one is and report it. I mean, I can't stress that enough. If we don't open our mouths and start reporting this stuff, it's going to continue to happen. It's going to get worse. Like I said, it's not snitching. It's not, you're there to give your loved one a voice and to protect them, as best as you can. So, like I said, you have to report this. You can't let it just go, you can't let it just go by and not report it. I mean, you have to. And Susan, I want to say this too, because I was reading and I asked you to send me that lawsuit that the guy filed about the TIER program. And what caught my eye in that article that you sent me is that when the guy filed the lawsuit originally, the judge in the case was just going to dismiss it, the lawsuit, because he didn't know if it had any merit. But because prisoners and the guys that had been on the TIER program for so long had been writing and filing lawsuits and filing stuff with the court on this stuff, that the judge finally said, and it was in the article, that he had been hearing numerous complaints about the TIER program, so he let the, he let the case move forward. And, that's just the same thing with the Department of Corrections. They hear enough of it, of something going on, hopefully they'll start to try to address it. I'm not very enthusiastic on hoping that they will, record keeping is very important when dealing with these people, and you have to report it, and you have to keep record on when you reported it, so we can hopefully try to get something done with it.
Yeah, well, we are here to give them a voice. Their voice is, just as the example you just gave indicates, they're often discounted as lying. But, in some cases, this one about the TIER program turned out to be true. One of the complainants in that, in one of the people in there who had been on the TIER program, one guy had been there 10 years. In the course of settling this, they called a corrections professional, Dr. Craig Haney, and asked him to examine the SMU at GDCP. He called it the most draconian prison he'd ever seen. He lambasted the them. I'm not sure they really changed much, but he said it was one of the worst he'd seen. He saw inmates who had been in completely blackened, lights out cells for months. They were nuts. I mean, he says these people had gone insane. The psychological stress of something like that. One man had been naked for, you know, such a long time. Another, there was blood all over the cell. I'm glad that there was an independent analysis of it, but the analysis itself is downright shameful. This state uses the Department of Corrections as to treat people terribly, and think about it, the Hindenburg crash, when the radio announcer's going, "Oh, the humanity." That's just what I think. We are losing our humanity if we do not think of the folks inside as people, and people with rights. And those rights include the right to live. They include a safe facility. They include adequate toilets, adequate showers, toiletries that are normally expected. In some cases, some people can't shave, but if they, you know, want shaves and haircuts, they should have access to them. And all that is in that particular lawsuit. It was a heartbreaking read. I thought it was just heartbreaking, shameful that the state of Georgia allows this to happen. Worst in
right.
the nation.
Right, and Susan, let's go back to the protective custody for a while, because something in your show notes that we haven't touched on is how the GDC and these institutions provide showers or whatnot to the prisoners that's in segregation and on protective custody. So shower days are done on Monday, Wednesday, and Friday. They shower three times a week while in the hole in segregation on protective custody. Showers are normally ran at most institutions, and you know, like I said, I worked in the hole while I did my time for not long, but I had a detail actually assigned to the hole. But anyway, they normally do the showers bright and early at 6 o'clock in the morning. Once the institution does shift change that morning on Monday, Wednesday, and Friday, they actually do showers. So they actually are only allowed to shower three times out of a week. Yard call, which I have a big problem with, is normally it's rarely ran in these institutions for segregation and protective custody. It's normally for if they run it, it's not like, you know, you watch the Longest Yard or you watch, you know, whatever you think yard call is for, like general population. No, that's in a dog cage, a kennel, whatnot, and they're put in this cage. And they're left out there until from about maybe 7:30, 8 o'clock in the morning to about 11 to noon in a dog cage, and that's their yard call, which is just, you know, unbelievable and pathetic. You know, that you would put humans in a cage and let them walk around for 3 or 4 hours instead of giving them some type of recreation. And, you know, that's how Georgia does it when it comes to recreation for segregation and protective custody.
It's worth adding to that in that cage, they have no protection from the wind or the sun. They have nowhere to sit except on the concrete. And they have no place to go to the restroom. They don't have access to water unless someone is thoughtful enough to bring it to them.
Right, yeah. And, you know, they get very limited time out of their cells. You know, at some institutions I know, at the one I was at when I was an orderly in the hole, they have coverings over their windows where they close these coverings where you can't see out of the window. You can't see, you know, what's going on in the dorm. You can't see, you know, who's at your door unless someone was to come up and open and actually open the flap over your window. So, you know, you're in this cell with very, very limited time outside of your cell, and you're in here with you're not seeing anything. The ways that majority of everyone have to communicate is through the heaters that's on the wall to talk to your next-door neighbor that's next to you. You have to communicate. They have to get down on their knees and actually yell through the heater to speak to the people that's next to them. I mean, you know, just thinking about it, it's just horrible. Just even thinking about how they're mistreated and how, you know, and the way that they look at it. And this is just my belief. I'm not saying that. My belief on how they look at it is, you know, the worstest people are in. There are in either on a tier protective custody or in solitary, and they're so much of a troublemaker that, you know, the hell with it. So be it. We'll put them in the room by themselves or with someone that we also think is just, and you know, that'll be their punishment. And you know, that's not right.
No. You know, it's heartbreaking. I don't care what they did in that regard. They deserve to be treated humanely. And Congress believes that as well. They passed the Civil Rights of Institutionalized Persons Act. Initially, that was passed in 1980. But at that time, they were intending to take care of what was happening in mental hospitals. Ultimately, there was enough attention put to it that most of the mental hospitals closed. The state mental hospital that Georgia had at Milledgeville housed 35,000 people at one time, 35,000. And when they closed it, they just walked away. But where did those people go? You know, they are in prison. And getting the same treatment.
Yeah, and unfortunately, it's sad because you have judges that sit on the bench, and like I said, I don't care if they're Democratic judges, Republican judges, whatever, but they actually think that giving sentencing someone to prison is going to actually help them. I mean, I've heard, how many times have you heard, and I'm sure a lot of people have heard it, where a judge will actually tell someone while they're getting sentenced that, well, you can get the help that you need in prison. No, you can't.
Yeah.
I mean, they have more stuff in prison than they do on the street. You know, there's no help in prison. You know, and I've heard counselors and deputy wardens and even wardens say that, you know, it's not. They're supposed to be advocates for your loved ones, especially the counselors. They're supposed to be advocates for your loved ones. They're supposed to help your loved one as much as possible, but they don't do that. I mean, I've heard, and when I was doing time, I did time one time where, and I've heard, since I found out that this lady who used to be a lieutenant at a facility. One time actually told me that we're only here to count you. We're only here to count y'all, and everything else to us is irrelevant. And this lady has went through the ranks from a lieutenant, and now she's a deputy warden of care and treatment. And she actually told me that we're only here to count y'all, and everything else is irrelevant to us. You know, so that's their way of thinking. That's their way of doing things, and you know they don't care about about your loved ones or anything like that. I mean, you've got to look at it. And Susan knows this case, and knows this. And I hate to keep alluding to Mr. Eddie Gozer, but his family till this day is still trying to get answers from the GDC on the death of Mr. Gozer. And his family actually contacted his counselor, and his counselor told them that it was above her pay grade to give them information on the death of Mr. Gozer. I mean, that is awful. I mean, where do they get some of these people at? And let me say this too, Susan, because we still have a few minutes. I commend, there are some officers that's in prison, that works in the prison system, that you know we know are good people. There are some, and I know from doing time that there are some that will help you, that do their job, and they come in to do their job, and they don't come in to mistreat people. And they'll do, go above and beyond, if you're in the hole, to bring you water, to bring you ice, to bring you, hot water, to bring you whatever it is that you need, to bring you the necessary forms for library or medical requests or grievance forms. There are some out there that do the right thing, but for a counselor that's supposed to be an advocate to tell a loved one, it is above my pay grade to give you any information. I mean, where do they get these people?
It becomes just rhetorical. They may not have been that when they were hired, but all around them is this institutional mentality of the GDC staff that inmates are worthless, liars, not worth the time of day, inconsequential, name the adjective, and if it's negative, that must be an inmate. And one of the women who used to be a nurse and then ultimately ended up being an inmate told me they will make the institutional characteristic was that they would make you hate the inmate, disregard the inmate, have disdain for the inmate. Just in general, incarceration in this country today is shameful, absolutely shameful. Just heartbreaking. It's why I'm involved. Until my son went to prison, I don't know that I even knew anyone who went to prison. Certainly never talked to him about it. And initially I was like, oh, well, that can't be good. No, you must be mistaken, son. No. They need our voice. They have none. There are some good people. There truly are, who work for the Department of Corrections. Likewise, there are some good people who are inmates.
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. So, like I said, someone asked me too. Let's touch on this. I think we got about 14 minutes left. But someone had asked me as well about the chaplain and church services for those in that's on. I know at Waycross, at Ware State Prison, they used to have the Gideon group that came through and I'm not very familiar with the Gideons. I just remember it. But they used to have them come through like two or three times a week, and they would go from cell to cell, and they'd ask if certain that they needed prayer or whatnot. But from my understanding and from my talking to people that's currently incarcerated or has been been in the hold or whatever, the chaplain and the religious aspect of the whole is zero to none as far as existence wise. That's a big neglected and I'm not just talking about Christianity, if that's their religion or whatever, but because we've heard of instances the last few weeks on Ramadan for people that's in the hole or on lockdown. They're not being able to fully participate in Ramadan. I think the religious, whatever the religious preference may be, that there is zero to none existence wise has been on, once that person is in the hole on whatever level tier, segregation or PC, they don't receive any type of religious. Well, I won't. Let me back up. They receive very limited religious things while in the hole.
In the TIER program, the Department of Corrections actually has in their SOP that initially they may be denied reading matter, whether that's a Quran or it's the Bible. Initially, they may have nothing to read. Right there, you can just sign me up for being crazy because I think I could bear being alone, but not being able to read.
And Susie, just think about it. If you don't give them any type of reading material or any type of material to keep their mind occupied on something that's going to keep their mind off of, doing something to reoffend, and then they're in there acting a fool, or doing things that they don't have any reason to be doing, a business to be doing, it's because they don't have anything to occupy their mind.
Yeah. I've wondered how so many people do become readers in prison. I've wondered how with the tablets they may be able to, I mean, they do it, but to have like a book club where people are all reading the same book and it's, and you get together and discuss it. I've been in book clubs over the years several times here in the free world, but I think that for someone who wasn't a reader before they went in, to have the experience of a book club once they have become a reader, it really it's a different experience to read something knowing that you're going to be talking with other people about it. And actually, I'm doing that right now with someone. I am reading the same book that he's reading, and we exchange emails about it. And it's just been a good experience for me, and I hope it's been a good one for him. But I don't see why that couldn't be accomplished. Some other things, using the technology they've got.
Yeah, and Susan, go ahead. I'm sorry. No, go ahead.
It's just that I think that the technology is there in their hands.
And I just don't understand the logic of denying certain things. I mean, and like I said, I won't get into too much of this, and because I don't know who actually listens, and I hope that, because we're discussing this, I wish that, and like I said, we don't know who listens, so, but I would hope that someone possibly within the GDC or the higher-ups you know, we got some of those people in these groups that create fake profiles and things like that, and they listen and think, and they break their neck to listen. But, you know, I hope that if they are listening, that they will, you know, use common sense and use knowledge. And if you want to keep these people out of trouble, and the way that technology has, the way that technology is now, you know, give them something useful to do. You know, they have these tablets, you know, let them use these tablets and, you know, to the best of their ability, and to use these tablets to keep them out of trouble. I mean, you know, at this point, I don't understand the logic behind their way of thinking that, you know, they're going to use these tablets for something that, you know, the wrong way. And with 60,000 people, of course, some of them are going to. But if you want to keep down the violence and you want to keep down the headaches and things that's taking place, you got to give them something to do. And sitting around a 120 man dorm, or sitting around a cell house or something all day doing nothing but watching TV, or doing it's not helping those people. Give them some classes. Give them, you know, let them take college courses. Let them do stuff that'll occupy their mind. You know, I don't know, Susan, if you know it, but the JPay, you could actually buy books from JPay. But do you know that the books are so outdated? I mean, it's like books from 1950 and 1960 that they can purchase on these tablets. I mean, it's not, and that's because the GDC doesn't allow these books to be put on there. It doesn't allow much of anything. So, you know, like I said, I don't mean to ramble on, but, you know, it makes no sense to me that they don't give them meaningful opportunities to advance themselves and to, you know, to become the better people. They don't do that, which is it beats me why.
But you remember the slogan, a mind is a terrible thing to waste. I think in the circumstance of prison, it's even worse, because that wasted mind is able to sit and think up. His or her thoughts aren't really directed toward accomplishment. And having goals and accomplishment matters in going through this life and making improvements, whether that's financial or educational, whatever. You need goals. You need opportunities. So much literature is in the public domain, long since copyrights have, you know, the copyright has been out many years. I think the copyrights are like 28 years. And then they go into the public domain. They are free. They are free. Can't these guys and ladies have access to that? So easy to do.
Yeah. Susan, we're running out of time.
Yeah.
I want to thank all the listeners that listened to us today. Hopefully the show was, you learned something from the show, and that you'll use it to apply, and that, you know, we answer some of the questions on extortion, and not just giving our opinion on it, but hopefully answer some of the questions that you may have. Susan, in the closing moments that we have, which is about 3 or 4 minutes, let the listeners know how they can contact you. Some of them probably know, some of them may not know. And then just tell us what you're working on and what you got coming up, and anything that you want the listeners to know.
Okay, thank you. I'm the founder of They Have No Voice, and we started as a Facebook group. Now, we are a private group because of security concerns in large part. But please ask to join if you'd like to. I've begun vetting people a little more formally than in the past. And if you have a, you know, if you happen to be incarcerated or using a fake profile and so forth, if I know that, I can work with that. But if I look for, you know, look for a genuine Facebook account and there's not one, I probably will delete the request to join. But we are involved every day in the civil rights of inmates. If not us, who? So, yes, you can reach out to me on Messenger, Susan Sparks Burns, and also in the group They Have No Voice, and now a page, THNZ Movement. So we've got plans to actually do something, not just talk, do something about some of these problems.
All right, and if you want to reach out to me, you can find me on Messenger, Joshua Heat Nation Randolph, and you can also find me in the official Georgia Prison News Facebook group. We just recently, this week, I think, changed over to the official page, and just like They Have No Voice, we are a private group because of security concerns and some past issues with the group of people being in that doesn't really need to be in there, that has their own motives and agendas or whatnot. But, you know, we're here to help family members and loved ones. You know, I think the same as with Susan. You know, unfortunately, we don't try to bash the GDC or, you know, we just want at the end of the day for those men and women to be treated humanely and, you know, for their right and to be protected. And, you know, we're not here to, you know, we would love in a perfect world to work with the GDC and accomplish these concerns and the things that go on. But unfortunately, that's not the case. But, you know, we have to keep on pushing and you know, hopefully accomplish what we're setting out to do. Like Susan said, it's you know, we're actually trying to do something. We're not just talking. You know, so hopefully you'll be a part of our, if you're not already, you'll be a part of our group. Susan, what's your group again?
It is They Have No Voice.
And mine is Official Georgia Prison News Group. Both you can find on Facebook by searching. All right, Susan, we are completely out of time, but I want you to, I want to thank you for joining me again this weekend. Sorry for the first technical difficulties, but, this show right here has been a success, and I hope people have enjoyed it, and that you'll go, if you're just, when you go back and listen, I hope you'll enjoy it. It'll be available within about 3 or 4 minutes after we get off. So, Susan, thanks again for being with me today, and we'll look forward to talking with you next weekend.
Okay. Thank you, Joshua. Great show.
All right. And until next Saturday, thanks again for listening, and we will catch you then.